It's because we have a lot of cases right now. We have also the knowledge that asymptomatic people may be able to spread, even if they're not the most effective spreaders, that it really is time for those people who may not have taken this seriously before to understand the seriousness of what's going on in our communities, the seriousness of being living through a pandemic. And particularly for those at high risk, this would be the week to stay home. And it may be next week as well, as cases continue to mount. But we do ask people, try to make other arrangements so that you're not going out of your house.
L.A. County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer urging Angelenos to stay inside this week, even avoiding grocery stores and pharmacies. Meanwhile, the National Institutes of Health is sponsoring 75 clinical trials across the world for a possible treatment for COVID-19. They're all testing a drug called remdesivir, which was originally developed as a treatment for Ebola. Some of those trials are happening at universities here in California, at UCSF, Stanford, and UCLA. And heading the trial at UCLA is Dr. Otto Yang, who joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us about this drug, remdesivir. It's been around for about a decade, right?
Yes. So as you mentioned, it was originally developed as a candidate for Ebola. It inhibits an enzyme that many viruses use to make copies of their genetic material. So it stops the virus from replicating by inhibiting their ability to copy their RNA. And this is a class of drugs similar to what's used for treating HIV.
So it doesn't kill the virus. It just basically stops it from repeating itself and taking over your body.
That's correct. It stops the virus from reproducing itself.
Okay. And so from what I've read and what I understand, the treatment is most effective if it's applied early on, before a patient gets really, really sick. Is that accurate?
Actually, we don't know yet. So we don't have results of any of these trials yet, but that would be our suspicion, and that's true for many treatments in general. So, for example, the Tamiflu that everybody's heard of for treating flu, that really is most effective if started within 48 hours of symptoms. And so we don't know if that's the case with remdesivir, but that's our suspicion.
And was it used to treat Ebola effectively?
It was used in over 100 patients, and it was not effective as far as they could see in that small number of patients.
And so why do people think it might be effective with COVID-19?
Well, because it cross-reacts and works against the polymerase enzyme in this virus, so at least in the test tube, it looks like it has good activity. And the hope is that that activity will translate into humans when we try it as a drug.
But it has been tried on humans with COVID-19 already, right?
It has been, but the true definitive trials, the placebo-controlled trials, so comparisons to sham treatment, the results really aren't back yet. So at this point, we just don't know.
And the results from your trials as well as the trials going on in China and elsewhere?
Yes, none of those results are back yet. My understanding is that there's a large study in China that the results should be available soon. Our own study here, the big one that we're part of, we don't have an idea because it's what's called double-blind, placebo-controlled. So half the patients are getting the drug and half are getting the placebo. And actually, we as a center don't know who's getting which, and that this is to prevent any sort of bias in terms of, you know, our caring for the patients. So we're actually blinded, and so we even don't know. Definitely we've had patients who've gotten the drug who have improved, and we don't know if they were on placebo or drug. And so that'll be figured out later as the trial nears completion.
When do you expect to have preliminary results?
Well, the trial should, at the current rate of enrollment, it should wrap up probably within a few weeks, 4 to 6 weeks. We could theoretically have results earlier, because the trial is monitored by what's called a data safety monitoring board. So most major clinical trials have that. And that's a group of scientists who actually look at the results real time. So they actually do have access to the identities of who's getting drug and who's not. And this one is meeting, I believe, weekly. And what they do is they look at what trends are developing over time. And so if, for example, the drug looked like it were helping patients very clearly, even with the trial not completed yet, they could halt the study and say that the results are good enough to say the drug is effective and the study should not continue. And alternatively, if the drug looked like it were completely not working or causing harm, they could also stop the study early and say, you know, the study's futile, it should not continue. So there's theoretically results earlier than the trial being completed.
Can this drug be given to patients who ask for it under a compassionate use guideline?
It can. So there's a compassionate use program through the manufacturer Gilead. So currently the compassionate use program is only prioritized for pregnant women and children because they are not eligible for the trial under the conditions, the settings of the inclusion criteria. But in general, it is not available for other people.
And I understand UCLA is testing other drugs to fight COVID-19. What are they?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are multiple ones. So one that we'll be studying soon is tocilizumab, and another is sarilumab. These are very similar agents that block what's called the IL-6 receptor. So if I could just take a quick step back and just kind of explain, the disease seems to fall into two major states. So the first earlier stage is the virus replicating and causing inflammation, some mild inflammation in the lungs, and that's fever and cough. And then some of those people will get better, and some of them will then proceed into the second stage, which is severe ongoing inflammation in the lungs and often throughout the whole body, causing a sepsis-like syndrome. And so, as you mentioned before, remdesivir and probably other antiviral drugs probably will work better in the first stage, because once the inflammatory stage starts, at that point, it's not so much about the virus anymore, and it's more about the immune response being overly active. And so both of those drugs I just mentioned are addressing the second stage. And so we have several other agents that are lined up to test against both stages of disease.
And when do you expect those trials to be completed, or at least have some results?
It's really hard to say, because the different trials are coming through different companies, and some of them are larger trials, and some of them are smaller, more preliminary trials. But I would imagine that there should be some preliminary results trickling in over the next few months.
And what is your opinion on hydroxychloroquine? This is the drug that we've heard a lot about, especially from President Trump, the anti-malaria drug. Do you think it's effective from what you've seen at all?
I will give you my personal opinion, and I very much hope I'm wrong, and I very much hope that people will laugh at me later and say you were so wrong. But my personal opinion is that it's going to be useless. And I'll give you the reason for that. This hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine have activity against multiple viruses in the laboratory. So it's active against HIV, active against influenza, active against dengue virus, active against chikungunya virus. There have been controlled clinical trials for all of these, and none of them have shown any benefit whatsoever. So I absolutely see no reason why it's going to be different for this virus.
All right. Well, we wish you all the speed and all the luck developing these treatments for COVID-19. So thank you very much, and thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That's Dr. Otto Yang, professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, and directing one of the trials for an antiviral drug to treat COVID-19. A week ago, Governor Gavin Newsom asked recently retired physicians, as well as nursing or med students, to sign up for the California Health Corps, and that's designed to add around 37,000 workers to the healthcare system during this crisis. Well, long before the governor issued his call, Dr. Chuck Wright answered it. He's a retired family physician in San Diego, and he came out of retirement last month to volunteer to help with the COVID crisis, and he joins me now. Hi.
Thank you, Madeline.
Why did you decide to do this and come out of retirement?
Well, I was in the Foreign Service for 20 years as a doctor for American embassies, and retired. I was able to retire at 62, but I thought I was just too young to just play golf and hang around at home. So I thought I've got this wonderful set of skills as a physician, and thought I'd put it to good use.
Well, 62 is young, but not young. When it comes to this virus, there are recommendations that people over the age of 60 in some places not even go outside, stay in the house and try to limit their exposure. Are you taking a personal risk doing this?
Yeah, I mean, I've got this great, you know, ability to help people. And I'm daily seeing patients, taking care of patients who are positive, and it's always in the back, you know, I'm always thinking, boy, if I get this, you know, I'm going to have a hard time fighting it off because of my age. But the desire to help is just stronger, I guess, in me than my fear of getting sick.
And so where have you been so far and what have you seen?
So I was in Asilomar, which is in Monterey, and we set up a site where we took care of the cruise ship passengers, the Grand Princess, and took care of them for about 2 weeks and sent them all home finally. And then we set up a new site in San Mateo County where we wanted to de-stress the local hospital. So anybody who was positive but couldn't go home, either to a nursing home or a place where they had people who were at risk, came to our site and, had lots of patients who would, you know, take out, you know, spend their time there before we could test them to be negative and send them back to the nursing home or to their loved ones.
So what is your biggest fear with hospitals discharging patients, and perhaps these patients do go home instead of going to a care facility like yours, a temporary facility? Is it possible that their symptoms could get worse at home and they'd have to be readmitted?
That's always a risk. You know, someone could all of a sudden take a turn for the worse. And, you know, there were a few patients we had that we watched them, but I think it was better than sending them back into a dangerous environment. We had several nursing home patients who, we debated, can we send them back? But we kept testing, and we really didn't want to send them back until they tested negative. We had a couple who were tested negative, and the next day tested positive. And we said, no, let's wait. We don't want to send, it's kind of like throwing a grenade into a nursing home if you send back somebody who's positive. So we didn't want to do that.
Yeah. So California has yet to hit its apex, and I guess I'm wondering what you're planning to do when California does hit its apex and ERs are overwhelmed, hospital beds are full, the triage centers are set up, patients are being sent, will be sent to the convention center here in Los Angeles. What do you plan to do?
Well, I'm taking a break. I've done it for a month, so I'm at home with my wife. But I'll probably go back out in the next week or so and man one of those sites and take some stress off the hospitals and do the best we can to manage patients. And hopefully we have enough PPE, personal protective equipment, so that I don't get sick myself. So it's going to be a bit overwhelming, but, you know, I think we're all going to do the best we can.
Do you have enough PPE right now?
In San Mateo, we did, not only in N95 masks, but we also had PAPRs, which are positive pressure ventilators. So, it's a day-to-day thing that we're looking at our supplies and the needs.
And where do you need more help from the authorities? What could either California authorities or the federal government do to help you?
I think the first is personal protective equipment. I mean, more masks, more gowns, more face shields, more gloves. We're constantly being told, you only have a 3-day supply of a mask, for example. Be prepared to do with less. So it's a bit scary to think that we're just going to use handkerchiefs to cover our mouth while we're dealing with somebody who's coughing in our face that we know is positive. And I think all of us in health care are willing to work long hours and take care of patients, but we'd like to minimize our own personal risk.
And is the state making any special accommodations for you because of your age or because you're coming out of retirement? Are they tailoring your work to reduce your risk?
For me personally, no. I think everybody kind of decides that on their own. We had a nurse just join us who was older than me. And I think she said, can I just do more administrative work than direct patient care? So I think everybody kind of assesses their own personal risk. I haven't seen a bigger mandate beyond that.
Well, are there a lot of doctors your age or older who are afraid for their own personal health and are making decisions based on that, saying, oh, I can't go to the front lines because I'm at risk?
Yeah, I think there are. I know there's a lot of my colleagues who said, I just don't want to risk it myself. And I don't fault anybody for saying, I don't want to take that risk. I would never say anything bad about anyone who said, look, I don't want to risk my family, so I'm not going to do it. And that's, you know, for me, it's an interesting equation because my wife has MS. She has multiple sclerosis, which puts her at risk. And so we have discussions about that. And I just got back from a month, and so I'm sleeping in a separate bedroom and keep my distance from my wife for a while until make sure that I have no symptoms. But it's, you know, it would be devastating if she got this because of the work I was doing.
And she's okay with it?
Yeah, yes. I mean, she understands the calling I have to help people, as long as I do what, you know, as much as I can to make sure that she doesn't get sick.
Well, I hope you stay safe and you don't get sick, and I hope she does as well. And I want to thank you for volunteering and for your service.
Well, thank you, Madeline. It's very kind of you.
Dr. Chuck Wright, he's a retired family physician in San Diego, and he's volunteering to help with the coronavirus outbreak. Coming up, if someone in your house gets sick, how do you take care of that person without getting sick yourself? We'll have some tips next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles officials say this week is key to stopping the spread of coronavirus. If you can, stay home. Don't even go to the grocery store unless you absolutely have to. LA County now has more than 6,000 cases. That's about double in a week. Because most of those cases probably will not require hospitalization, it'll fall on families to care for the sick people in their homes. And here to tell us how to do it safely is Dr. Richard Jackson, professor emeritus at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, and he headed the California Department of Public Health in the mid-2000s. Welcome to the program, Dr. Jackson.
Pleasure to be with you, Madeline.
Well, let's backtrack. Before someone gets sick, what should people do to prepare for the possibility that someone might get sick in our house? What should we be laying in terms of supplies?
You know, I think the first thing is to assume that somebody will get sick because nobody regrets over-preparing. So one thing is to have the food, the soups, plenty of good drinking water. I would recommend acetaminophen, which is also sold as Tylenol, gloves, masks, if you can get them, bandanas if you can't. If you possibly can figure out a separate room where if someone were sick, they could be there. Not all families obviously have that opportunity, but if you can, that's better to have it that way. And of course, the disinfecting wipes and the things we've all talked about.
Hmm. Even if they are practicing social distancing and not going out of the house at all?
This is a stinker of a virus. It's relative to the common cold. It's pretty good at getting by masks and onto surfaces. One thing that I think is important is the bigger the dose of the virus, the more likely you are to get sicker. And I don't think people realize that if you can at least reduce your exposure, and the mask does that, or the person being ill wearing some kind of protective bandana or something over their face is a good thing as well. Social distancing is very important. It's extremely important from a public standpoint because what we really want to do is really tamp down the rate in our population.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we're trying to avoid going to the grocery store this week. We're trying to avoid going out at all. But let's say you are in the house with someone who has developed symptoms. What should be the first thing that you do?
If you're in the house and now you're worried about a loved one, knowing who to call and where to call, what's the phone number for their primary care practitioner? Obviously, you're going to need to know if you ever had to make a call for 911 to know how to do that as well. Preparing the room so it's safe and healthy, having the bedclothes there. I think having an ability to bring food in there for the individual and fluids, and if they possibly can, to have their own bathroom because and keep that scrubbed down as well, having the disinfectant and gloves present.
Okay, but as a caregiver, what should you do to protect yourself? If you're going into the room to deliver food and medicine, you're potentially exposing yourself.
The caregiver, oftentimes the loved ones in the family, need to be wearing masks when they go in there, and they should ask the person who's ill, make sure the person who's ill is wearing a mask as well. They should be wearing gloves. They should deliver that food and collect the dishes afterwards. And clearly you're not going to share those dishes with anyone else. Have them assembled and cleaned separately. One of the other aspects that I'm hearing about is, you know, the caregivers are becoming worn out. They may have several children in the home they're trying to deal with at the same time. And by the way, the caregiver may have siblings that may want to help care for the, and oftentimes it's an older person that you're most worried about. So figuring out a schedule for this is also important.
So that you're not the only one giving care and getting worn out.
It is not easy to take care of really sick people. And think about how hard a lot of your listeners are finding just to be social distancing and staying home all the time, particularly with a family there and all the rest. And then to have the work of caring for someone, making sure you're doing the laundry, preferably that is coming out of that room, preferably in hot water, and don't shake out the sheets or the bedclothes when you do it. Just put it directly in the washing machine. So there is a fair amount of work when you have someone sick in the house. You need to also have a thermometer. Nowadays, we can just use the skin surface thermometer, and that ought to be in the house. Oftentimes, the people that get most sick have a low temperature for the first couple of days, and then it begins to spike upward. And that's something the doctor, the EMTs, are going to want to know about. And the increase in symptoms, the cough becoming worse, that is often a time that this is becoming much more serious. People need to know about it.
Hmm. All right. So when is the time that you should think, okay, this person needs to go to the hospital? What should you be looking out for?
You know, if the person becomes more confused, and often that's a sign of oxygen levels not being high enough. Secondly, clearly if there was any kind of chest pain, tightness in the chest, that is important. And you need to consider very seriously going to the hospital in that situation. Extreme shortness of breath, and we call it air hunger, is a very important sign. And that is an important time to call for help.
All right. But again, most people will not need to go to the hospital.
80% of the people have fairly transient, sort of unpleasant symptoms, but they get better. About 15%, sometimes 20%, depending on the age group, become worse. And those are the folks we have to watch closely.
And finally, how long can we expect an illness like this to last? If someone doesn't have to go to the hospital, how long will they be sick in the house?
In the house, it can range from 3 to about 10 days. Folks that are hospitalized, most often I'm hearing the numbers around 6-7 days. I've just had a good friend get out of the hospital after 6-7 days, did not need intubation, but he said it was the toughest illness he's ever had.
Well, Dr. Jackson, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Madeline.
That's Dr. Richard Jackson. He's Professor Emeritus at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Coming up, Hollywood production has ground to a halt, and that means a lot of people out of work for the foreseeable future.
It's a hard time right now to just even try to see, you know, what you can do because there's so much uncertainty.
The ripple effects of a Hollywood quarantine next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, last year, Americans spent more than $11 billion going to the movies. Now, no one's going anywhere. Movie, TV, and commercial production is dead for the moment. From Culver City to Santa Clarita, local productions have been shut down. Nearly a million people work in the industry. Another 1.5 million are tied to the industry. People like caterers, drivers, cleaners, hairdressers, it goes on and on. For a total of about $44 billion into the local economy. Most of that dried up. We're going to talk about that with three guests, two of whom work in the industry. But let's begin with an overview. Ryan Fonder is a Hollywood business reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hey.
Well, so I assume most of the big studios are shut down pretty much completely, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's no production happening, which, you know, social distancing basically makes any but the smallest type of like YouTuber productions essentially impossible. Writers' rooms are still kind of going. Writers are writing remotely. So development is happening for when movies are able to be made once again. But yeah, for the most part, you're starting to see studios shutting down, you know, some furloughing workers and that kind of thing.
Well, I guess no one knows when production will come back, right? So how long will the writers' rooms be happening?
That's a great question, because at some point you start to get a backlog of material, right? And if you don't have anyone to produce the things that are being written, it's, you know, it kind of makes you wonder how long that system is sustainable. I mean, the other big question is, when do the movie theaters open again? That's kind of like the thing that I've been focused on lately, because, you know, as you know, they've been shut down for a couple weeks now. And there seems to just be, you know, no end in sight, really. And until then, the studios don't know when they're going to release movies. And so the schedule's just all thrown off. So that's kind of a lot of the conversations happening at the studios right now are about, okay, when do we think the cinemas will be open again? And when that happens, when do we think we can put our movies on the schedule in a way that doesn't just cannibalize everything?
So what are they saying about the movie theaters reopening? Are they privately wondering if they'll ever reopen?
I don't think they're privately wondering whether, you know, movie theaters will continue to exist. I mean, I'm pretty sure that once things open up and people get comfortable again, people are going to want to go out and do things. And that's kind of what movie theaters are banking on. In the meantime, you're starting to see studios adapt to the new reality. You're starting to see studios put more films on VOD. Studios are in kind of a wait and see mode right now, but for some movies they are thinking, you know, maybe it's worth it, better off just to put it straight on streaming or VOD.
Is there anything that is still shooting? I'm thinking possibly animation, which doesn't require a big set with people on it.
Yeah, and you're able to do voiceover work remotely, so that's good. Podcasts are a huge industry, and that's still happening. And actually, we just did a fairly big story on this streaming service called Quibi, which relies on a lot of productions to be ongoing. Like, you know, I talked to one producer who had set up this entire loft in Manhattan in the Flatiron District to do this set for the show. And they basically had to scramble at the last minute to get, you know, remote sessions going with their two hosts in Brooklyn separately so that they could actually continue this thing so it could launch on Monday. Pretty amazing.
What is it, like a talk show?
Yeah, it's like a talk show. It's based on this podcast called The Nod, which focuses a lot on black culture and pop culture and things like that. So it's these two hosts. They do interviews. They go out in the field. This current situation just made that a lot different, but not impossible.
No one's going out into the field.
No one's going out in the field without a mask or gloves at this point. Yeah.
So all the productions that were in the middle of shooting or were about to begin shooting, what happens to those? Are they just over? Are they dead?
They're not dead, but one of the big questions is, you know, how much those production companies will stand to lose as they hold on indefinitely. And right now, it's unclear. You know, we've tried to investigate a little bit about how much they'll be able to recoup from insurance. Right now, the bigger studios, it looks like, you know, if you delay a production, yeah, you can talk about eating costs of $100,000 a day on a, you know, medium to large scale production. So that's not an insignificant amount of money.
But until there's a vaccine, how many people are going to want to go into a movie theater with a bunch of other people?
That is a great question. And one that the studios and the theater chains are grappling with. Even if the movie theaters reopen in, say, June, July, in time for some of these big movies that the studios have planned, the theaters are probably still going to be doing social distancing measures for a little while, you know, having people sit two seats apart or having whole rows that they're just not going to sell tickets for. Eventually, people will start to get comfortable and get out and go places.
All right. Well, let's hope. Ryan Fonder is Hollywood business reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, now let's hear from a couple of industry members who are being directly impacted by this. Judy Napolitano is co-owner of Camille's Culinary Creations. She provides craft services for productions. Hi, Judy.
Hi. How you doing, Madeline?
I'm well, thank you. And Sarah Phillips is a freelance cinematographer. Welcome to you.
Hi, thanks.
Well, thanks for being here. And let's begin with you. I understand that the time when you make most of your money typically is in the spring, which would be now. So what has happened to your business and how are you faring?
So, yeah, I primarily work in independent films. So it would be features, shorts, digital content, some music videos, some commercials. The commercials are probably the bigger budget thing. So for me, the commercials have all been pushed, but because they are, it's a significantly bigger sort of deal because you get awarded the bid based on creative. And so once that train is sort of going, the goal is to keep it still a train.
Uh-huh.
So those have all been pushed at least 2 months. As far as the more independent things, that just moves back to the back burner because a lot of the independent investors are sort of taking a step back to see where all of this puts us and where all this lands.
So you're talking about independent films, smaller budget movies that investors might have second thoughts about now.
Yeah. One of my friends works in development, actually. She just had a film fund fall apart. And as I said, the spring is our super busy time. Normally I'm working like Jan 15 to July 1 back to back, where I'll have maybe 4 or 5 days down. So I'm optimistic that this will maybe front load the summer and fall, but that hasn't yet to be seen.
Right. Can you ride it out until summer or fall?
We'll see. Everybody's holding their breath. I applied for unemployment a few weeks ago, actually, and got the amount back, and it is significantly lower than it should be according to their calculations that they put online, and it's certainly not sustainable. So, I mean, the one thing you can say, like, so freelancers are accustomed to up and down. So we certainly planned for ups and downs, but we're also coming out of the holiday and winter season, which is the slow season that generally it would be picking up right now and we would be slammed. So my husband and I will be sort of fine. I know a lot of people that will be completely drained, if not wrecked, just because right now is, you know, unemployment certainly is not going to pay anyone's rent in L.A.,
Judy, over to you. You are a caterer, and you had a very successful business, I understand, until this. What's happening
Correct.
Now?
Nada. There's nothing since production's dry. You know, nothing's happening. We don't have anything on our calendars. You know, we had things, and everything got canceled. You know, and hearing Sarah say that independent, because we do a lot of independent films and commercials and video shoots and photo shoots. And so when she said that a lot of the independent investors are sort of, you know, pulling back and questioning, that sort of made me gulp going, oh, dear, you know, that's not good for me because that's the niche that we are in.
Yeah. And you have a pretty lean operation, right? It's just you and your daughter?
It's just correct. Correct.
So when you're looking at this current scene and the possible future of not a lot of work, what are you thinking? What do you think you could do to make some money?
Well, you know, that's a hard one. We did have a sandwich shop at one time and maybe try to revive that again. But that's not, you know, the bulk of our business. You know, really the past 10 years, we developed this from starting in farmers markets and selling baked goods into growing into catering. And since 2010, we have been doing, you know, catering in the film sets, and that's what we really grew. And we do private individual catering. So, you know, we'd have to try to, you know, branch out to do more of private events or corporate events and things like that. But it's very difficult. It's a hard time right now to just even try to see, you know, what you can do, because there's so much uncertainty out there.
And do you get any help from the government for your business?
No. I just even went online a while ago to apply for a grant, and it was for small businesses. And I always laugh, you know, when people say small businesses and they say under 500, and that's always, I don't know who came up with a small business was under 500. But because it's just the two of us and I don't have a payroll, we ended up not qualifying, because everything's about helping your payroll right now, and which I understand. But it's also like, well, what happens to the people that are just independent? Where's the support for us?
And Judy, how much longer do you think you can hang on before it gets really dire for you?
Fortunately, I come from a large family, so... and that's always been the support system when it happened before. So I pray that it's not going to be the doomsday that it sort of feels like it could be. I'm hoping that, you know, things, production start to pick up, but there really is, you know, no answer to that. I go out and get a job at Costco? I don't know. I might have to. It's just not an easy thing to say, oh, I can reinvent the wheel and go get another job, because right now nobody's working.
Well, I wish you both the very, very best, and I hope you can hang on until things get better, and I hope they get better relatively quickly for both of you.
Indy will come back. It's just a little bit of a trickle down, so it'll take a minute, but don't worry. They'll still need catering.
People need to be fed. Right. In my head, it's just like I'm hoping that the ones that were put on hold will be coming back.
Well, here's hoping. I hope so, too. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for reaching out to us.
Sarah Phillips is a freelance cinematographer, and Judy Napolitano is co-owner of Camille's Culinary Creations. She's a caterer. Documentary to watch at home, how a small group of activists took on the political machine and won. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The upside-down elephant, the snake, the seahorse, the octopus, the praying mantis. Visualize what each of those animals might look like, and then drop them onto a map of the United States. Then you'll have a handful of actual voting districts, artificially engineered to ensure that a political party's candidate of choice never faces serious opposition. That's called gerrymandering, and it's been around almost as long as the United States itself.
Gerrymandering from 1788 through 2000 is in its minor leagues. In 2010, gerrymandering jumps straight into its steroids era. Big data and big technology emerge in such a way that you can carve more precise gerrymanders than ever.
Well, what changed a decade ago, and how have citizens and the courts responded? We're going to ask those questions of Chris Durance, director of a new documentary called Slay the Dragon. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Good, thanks. And central to that movie is the story of Katie Fahey. She's an activist who led a grassroots effort against partisan gerrymandering in Michigan 3 years ago. Hi, Katie.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. All right. So, Chris, the name of your documentary, Slay the Dragon. I imagine the dragon is one of these crazy gerrymandering shapes, animal shapes.
Exactly. I mean, and when we see Katie, she's wearing this, you know, epic T-shirt showing exactly what they're all about, which is trying to slay the dragon. But it's also a David versus Goliath type of story. Mm. I mean, this is really the purest expression of democracy in the form of Katie and the citizens' movement that she galvanizes. up against a small cabal of self-serving, self-interested politicians. I mean, it's fantastic to watch that unfold.
Katie, how did you become the David in this David and Goliath story?
Well, accidentally. In 2016, I'm from Michigan, and we had a lot going on, including the Flint water crisis. And I was fed up with the system. I was fed up with politicians not being accountable to the voters. And so I made a Facebook post, not actually thinking it would lead to a political movement or amending our state constitution, that said, hey, I'd like to take on gerrymandering in Michigan. If you'd like to do so as well, please let me know. Smiley face. And then all of a sudden, I was connected with thousands of other strangers across Michigan who also wanted to take on gerrymandering.
What did gerrymandering have to do with the Flint water crisis?
Yeah, well, in Michigan, we had a law passed called the Emergency Manager Law, which basically took away local control from decision-making rights. And the people of Michigan didn't like that law, so they actually petitioned to appeal it and were successful, except then our newly gerrymandered in Congress decided to reinstate it once they found a loophole. And that emergency manager got given to Flint, Michigan, and they are the one who actually made the decision to switch the water source. So somebody who was unelected and that the people actually tried to repeal were successful in doing, but then the legislature ignored that decision anyways.
And so that when they switched the water source, that's what led to all the lead contamination problems.
Yes.
That's what happens when you sever the link between elected representatives and the people that they're meant to serve. And that's exactly what happened in Michigan. And Flint was this tragic consequence that grew directly out of that.
Right. And you point out in the film, as we heard in the introduction, this gerrymandering move, and it wasn't just in Michigan, it was in other states, really got into high gear after the election of Barack Obama. And at that time, the House and Senate were also controlled by Democrats. So everyone thought the Republican Party was pretty much dead, at least for the time being. And then in comes a guy named Chris Jankowski. Tell us about him, Chris.
Chris Jankowski is this fascinating character. He's a Republican Party operative, but he's not well known. He operates at the state and local level, but he is a genius. And what happened after Barack Obama got elected is Republicans saw the writing on the wall. And what they figured was the only way to get back in power was to use this arcane trick through gerrymandering. I mean, and so they aimed at 2010. 2010 is a census year, but it's an off-year election. And they figured this is a Tea Party wave. They figured they'd be popular. They figured they'd do pretty well. But what Jankowski did was he figured out exactly how to control the redistricting, because he knew win power in 2010 and he could control politics in a dozen states and in the Congress for the next 10 years. And he did it.
And that's because the districts are drawn every 10 years to coincide with the new census.
Absolutely. So 2010 was a huge election. We're talking in 2020, a huge election. Everyone is going to be talking about the presidential election, about the primaries. But, you know, for people like Chris Jankowski, they know that where real power lies in America is by controlling the lines. You control the lines, you can control legislation up and down the ballot for a decade.
And that's what happened in your state, Michigan, right, Katie?
Yes.
So how do you get people excited about this issue? Because admittedly, while very important, I mean, it has to do with voting rights, it's not the sexiest of issues.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I saw in 2016 is really interesting. I had a lot of friends and family for the first time getting really excited about voting. And when I looked to see why that was, it was really over two different people, President Trump, at the time, candidate Trump, and Bernie Sanders. And when I thought about what do those two maybe have in common, their core messages, the things I was seeing all over Michigan on yard signs and bumper stickers, were the political revolution or our political revolution and drain the swamp. And I was like, well, you can elect people to try and do that, but also we as citizens of Michigan could try too through the gerrymandering process. And that's when people started to really get excited on, wow, there's actually something I can do with all this frustration I have.
So you looked at the idea of creating a citizens commission to take drawing of the political district lines out of the hands of politicians and put into the hands of a nonpartisan commission.
Yeah, we had looked at other states and what they had done, and there was a handful of states who had tried different ways to end gerrymandering. When you're ending gerrymandering, there's three main ways that you change it. It's usually who's drawing the lines. So politicians have the largest conflict of interest because in many cases, they're actually choosing which voters they are going to have vote for them in the next election. But you can also change how the lines are drawn, in what ways those lines need to be drawn. And the last kind of criteria is in what process are those lines drawn? Is it done behind closed doors? Is it a vote? Do you have people be able to submit maps? And then we went across the state in Michigan. We did 33 town halls in 33 days asking our fellow Michiganders, what do you want? Who do you want to draw the lines? How do you want the lines to be drawn? And what part do you want to play? And that's how we ended up crafting our language that ended up being an independent citizens redistricting commission.
Which is pretty much what we have here in California.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, California taught us a lot about the process, and we tweaked it based on what California learned. We actually had some of California's commissioners come out to Michigan because I think people were just really skeptical. They were like, can regular citizens do this? But also, can regular citizens do this with the benefit of trying to create representative districts instead of partisan districts? And the really great thing about hearing from California commissioners is we had a Democrat, a Republican, and an independent, and they really talked about how this is kind of like the ultimate way to do your civic duty when you're really at the center of making such important decisions that then last for the next 10 years.
And Chris, it's not just about putting people into power. It's about enacting laws and laws that are favorable to the people who redraw the lines. What are some of the laws that once these districts were redrawn after Chris Jankowski was successful, what kinds of laws were then put into place in these states?
What we've seen is a whole host of things being done that reflect this disconnect between voters and politicians. And because these politicians are unaccountable, they do whatever they want. So you see bathroom bills in North Carolina. You see laws on gun rights in states where they wouldn't necessarily be enacted absent gerrymandering. You see inaction as well. I mean, there's a lot of public pressure to see, you know, action on education, action on climate, action on water safety, all sorts of things that many citizens would like to see enacted, but get absolutely nowhere. Because when you have an unaccountable state legislature, they don't have to do anything. And it's hugely frustrating for citizens. And that's exactly what Katie tapped into. She found that a lot of people felt all alone. And by putting this message out on Facebook, by bringing people together on first online, and then, as we see in the film, in this physical space, that they're galvanized. They realize that they can do something.
So you went through the voter initiative process, right, Katie, in Michigan, which same thing happened here. It was on the ballot as an initiative because I guess state lawmakers wouldn't on their own take the power out of their own hands and create a citizens commission, right? I mean, but not all states have this process. So how can they do this if they want to, if they don't have an initiative process?
Yeah, and it really is. I mean, when you're talking about these like systemic basic building blocks of our democracy, like redistricting and voting laws, what we did see, though, is with more knowledge about gerrymandering and more people realizing really how screwed up their maps were, there were court cases that were brought, like in Pennsylvania, where they could go and say, you know, this was drawn unconstitutionally. This was drawn to suppress certain voters' votes. And that's what the Supreme Court ultimately said, is that, you know, at the state level, they can try and handle that. Now, different states have varying levels of partisan courts. But thankfully, we've seen a couple different examples across the country of maps being redrawn. You don't change who's drawing them, unfortunately, but they will get redrawn if they were drawn too illegally.
So it's 2020, which means, as you said earlier, we are in a census year. What do you expect to happen when it comes to redistricting?
Well, one of the biggest things is the census is out there, and making sure that the data that's actually used to redistrict is really important, and making sure that all communities are counted so that then these lines can reflect accurate populations is a really big thing. I know that, you know, the census isn't always the sexiest topic, but it actually is really important, especially for harder to reach communities. The other thing is we have a handful of governor's races up, I think something like 33 across the country. There will be different in-state legislators that are going to be up. And those are the people who will be drawing these lines in most states. That's important because if you have one party that ends up having the entire the governorship as well as the House and Senate in a state, then they're going to be able to gerrymander in an extreme way. The amount of data that political parties now have on people, they can very accurately determine which houses are voting Democrat and Republican, and they will literally go to the neighborhood level and decide which voters they want and which voters they don't.
And this isn't just a Republican issue, right? I mean, Democrats have gerrymandered to their own advantage as well over the years.
Completely. If anything, it's just in 2010, the Republicans were a lot smarter about it. They just were more strategic and they were looking at the long game.
So who's the Democratic version of Chris Jankowski? Is there one?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's probably at the state level in those states. I know Illinois has some bad Democrat gerrymandering, too. But usually, like even in Michigan, for example, though it wasn't a Democrat this time, in the 80s, there were Democrats who did it.
But what they try and do is they try and stay unknown, because the reason this works is that the wider public is not aware that it's even happening. And so to Katie's point, we've just got to be informed. We've got to be engaged citizens. We can't just vote. Voting is fantastic. We've got to do more than that. The maps in 2020, for the most part, are going to be fought on the rigged maps of 2010. A lot of people don't realize that. So even before you cast your vote, the result in many, many cases is preordained. You know, when people realize that, it's kind of shocking to think. The onus is on us. The Supreme Court is not going to be there to save us. It's on us. It's on people like Katie, but it's on all of us to get involved and make a difference.
Chris Durance and Katie Fahey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And their documentary is called Slay the Dragon. And that's it for us today at Press Play. Stay safe. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.